You know, the state of Texas is one of the few states in the country that still has the death sentence on its books. And it's one of even fewer that actually exercises that option on a regular basis. I say that not because I want to open up a dialogue about the death sentence. Quite frankly, I've got no problem with it. But just to point out, that's the reality. For the most serious, the most significant crimes in Texas, all of involving murder, or the loss of life, and I think if you say Tejas instead of Texas, that's the other one. You know, that's the only one you can get the death sentence for if you don't get it. But it's for the most serious offenses. And in Texas, if you are unfortunate enough to be charged with a criminal offense and found guilty and sentenced to death, what most people don't realize is that sentence is automatically appealed. There is no such thing as a death sentence that is arrived at or assessed at a trial court level that is just left at that level. Even if you are convicted and you get the death sentence and you say, that's fine, I did it, they got me on tape, you know, I deserve to die, your sentence will still be appealed. Your case will be appealed. Automatic. It's kind of a built-in hedge against injustice and bias. I'm not against that. It is an extreme sentence, so it should have extreme review. But in Texas, if your case is appealed, you appeal first to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Makes sense, doesn't it? If you're not, now that's the only guaranteed appeal. That's the only one you absolutely get. But almost routinely, if that appeal is denied, you go up to the Texas Supreme Court. If it's denied in the Texas Supreme Court, under certain circumstances, you can appeal to the federal level. And you would appeal to the, out of Texas, we go to New Orleans, to the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. Although really, when's the last time you heard of justice being used in connection with New Orleans on anything? Kind of gives you some insight. Never, yeah. And if you fail in the appeals court, the Fifth Circuit Court in New Orleans, you could, under very limited circumstances, make it all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, often referred to as the court of last resort. In this country, the Supreme Court of the United States is our ultimate court of last resort. It is the court that has the authority to overrule the rulings of every other court. No matter what that court is, if you make it to the Supreme Court, they have the authority to overrule the lower court's decisions. And, of course, the whole purpose of your appeal is, first of all, delay the death sentence and ultimately avoid being sentenced to death. That makes sense, doesn't it? Well, back in 484 BC, if you were in the Persian Empire and you were Jewish, you were under a death sentence. You hadn't done anything wrong. You hadn't committed a capital offense. You may have been the most law-abiding, tax-paying citizen in the entire Persian Empire, but by virtue of this edict, handwritten by Haman and sealed by Ahasuerus, you are under a sentence of death. The 13th day of Adar is your death, is your execution date. And you know, if you knew when you were going to die, if I knew when I was going to die, you know, we'd be watching the calendar and checking off the days. And you know that's what's happening in Persia. There is no appeal. In Persia, when you're sentenced by the king, there is no appeal. And so the plight of the Jewish nation, because the entire nation is within the Persian Empire. You know, we think today, well, if you're Jewish or any nationality, you're kind of spread around the globe. Back then in 484 BC, you weren't spread around the globe. You were within the Persian Empire. So the entire nation, their position is hopeless. And Mordecai, one man, makes an unprecedented decision. He begins, really, an appellate process. Mordecai begins to appeal Ahasuerus's decree. It's never been done before. There's no reason to think that this will work. After all, there are only three possible people within the entire empire who might hold enough power to change that decree. Ahasuerus, and he can't change it because the Persian emperor is right even when he's wrong. Haman, he's not going to change it. Wicked Haman. This is his fault anyway. Haman's not going to change it. And Esther, and she's a girl. Those are your three shots. But Mordecai appeals. And as he goes through really a three-step appellate process, we see as he fails and he fails until he finally reaches the court of last resort. When he reaches the court of last resort, finally he finds a sympathetic ear in God himself. Finally he finds a judge who is willing, ready, and able to overturn every other court below him. Today we look at Esther chapter 4. We're going to read verses 4 through the end of the chapter. We're really not going to get to the end of the chapter, but I'm going to really try to get through the first 14 verses. But just for context, we read verses 4 through the end of the chapter. Remember, in the first three verses, Mordecai and the rest of the expatriate Jewish nation went into mourning. Sackcloth, ashes, fasting, and mourning. So we pick it up at 4. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. They told her about Mordecai sitting at the gate in sackcloth and ashes. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. Then Esther summoned the king's eunuch, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. Remember, Mordecai couldn't go through the gate and enter the palace grounds because he was in mourning. He could only go to the gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her, and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. All the king's servants and people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, that he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. They related these words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish." Interesting, since Mordecai is the only other relative. I might have chosen my word just, "and you will perish." Let's not drag Mordecai into this. "And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." We'll leave it there. You know, the stage is really set. We've seen it build for the last three chapters, and now the stage for the conflict is set. The edict has been issued. The expatriate Jews are in mourning. Time is running out, and Mordecai is in front of the gate in sackcloth and ashes. Everyone, every Jewish individual, man, woman, and child in the entire kingdom is in mourning, just like Mordecai. Everybody's accounted for but one person, Esther. Where, oh, where is dear little Esther? You know, as I thought about it, she's not way down yonder in the pawpaw patch, is she? She's up in the palace. It's amazing that as the destruction of her people draws near, Esther is alive, well, and oblivious. She is in the tower, she is in the palace, completely oblivious to the plight of her own people. She's been married at this time for 5 years. And in that 5 years, you see an isolation that's taken place. Esther's become very isolated from her own covenant community. Esther has become, in effect, more Persian and less Jewish every day. She has become so isolated that she is completely unaware that this decree, which threatens the life of every single man, woman, and child she has ever known, she's unaware this decree has ever been issued. She's so isolated. She's unaware that every one of her Jewish compatriots from India to Ethiopia is wearing sackcloth and ashes and in mourning. They're fasting because her life goes on just as it's always been for the last 5 years, the pampered life of a queen. You know, I think there's really a warning to us as Christians, as just human beings on this planet. It's easy for us to live isolated lives. You ever notice that? You ever thought how isolated your life is? I mean, this isn't a time to just stand up and weep and wail about how isolated you are. But I was thinking this week as I was reading this, how isolated or how easy it is to become isolated. What are our lives really about? Our lives are about ourselves and our immediate families. And then we branch out maybe to those close friends we have. or the people we know at work. But our lives don't go much beyond that. It's easy to become isolated. It's even to become isolated from the church community. You know, one of the purposes of corporate worship is to maintain personal contact among believers. I mean, the primary focus of communal worship is what? Yeah, it was worship. Yeah, it's right in the title. Worship. But one of the byproducts of that is that we are to maintain contact with the Christian community, that we are to maintain contact with those members of the Christian community that God has placed us with. That's one of the purposes of the prayer chain, of the prayer list every week, is so that we can share in each other's needs and hopefully assist in those needs. We need to guard against that tendency to be isolated because it doesn't happen overnight. With Esther, this was a 5-year progress. This was a 5-year procession. It doesn't happen overnight. But Esther is isolated. And you notice, nobody in the palace has thought to even notify Esther. Wouldn't you think that if someone in the palace had heard about this decree, and people in the palace, I'm sure, knew about it, they would have gone to Esther and said, "Hey, Esther, you've got problems." But what had Esther been carefully doing for 5 years? Yeah, concealing her identity. She didn't want anybody to know she was Jewish. There was no reason for anyone to notify Esther that she herself might be under a death sentence because nobody knew. She was so absorbed into the culture, so absorbed being queen, that no one had a clue that Esther was part of the covenant community. You know, hopefully this will never happen in our lifetimes. But if the government passed, if our federal government passed a law that imposed sanctions on Christians, on believers, on their lifestyles, on our lifestyles, how many of your unsaved neighbors, your unsaved co-workers would think they needed to warn you? Based on what they know of you, how many people who know you outside your church family or your family would think, "Oh, you know something? I heard about this law. I need to go tell them." Is there anything about your conduct, your life, your testimony that would alert them? Or would you be like Esther and the servants? No need. No need. Now, Mordecai begins an appellate process. And that appellate process is contained in 3 dialogues that we're going to see through the rest of chapter 14. I almost said that these are dialogues between Mordecai and Esther, but they're really not. They're between Mordecai and a eunuch and Esther and a eunuch. Esther's isolation is so extreme that by this point she doesn't even contact or come face to face with the guy who raised her, with this guy she looked as a father, with someone who looks at her as a daughter. That's how isolated she's become. We look at these 3 appeals because these are, in each dialogue, we see an appeal. The first one is in verses 4 and 5. Keep in mind, Mordecai's outside the palace gate. He's in sackcloth, he's in ashes, he's mourning, he's fasting, and Esther's maidens and eunuchs came to her and told her about it. It's pretty hard to miss somebody who's in mourning. It's pretty hard to walk by the guy in sackcloth, in the goat hair onesie. It's pretty hard to miss that guy. He's the guy in the ashes. He's that guy. What was her response to this? She's notified of a problem. He's in mourning. And keep in mind, this is severe mourning. Even in the ancient world, there were degrees of mourning, just like there are degrees of mourning in our world. But there were degrees of mourning. The kind of mourning that Mordecai is exhibiting is the extreme form of mourning. Now, given this report, Esther's troubled, and what does she do? Yeah, she sends him some clothes. She says, "Take that man a shirt and tie." They tell her that Mordecai is outside at the gate. He's wearing a goat hair outfit. He's dumping ashes on his head. He's fasting. He's wailing. And her response is, you know, "Go, be filled and be warm. Take a change of clothes." Now, is there anything really wrong? Yeah, Gene. What do you mean? No, they all would do it. Men would do it, and women would do it. She writhed in anguish. She had an emotional response to an appeal. And we're going to get to that in a minute because that's really how the world responds. An emotional response and throw money at it. Well, they told her, though. They told her. So Esther's been notified. She, and is there anything wrong with sending them some clothes?
Are you sure she didn't send him the clothes so that he could come inside and talk to her?
She never summoned him to come inside. So yes, I'm sure. Because this is all she did. This was her solution, was to send him clothes. What didn't she do that you might expect her to do? What are some of the things that she didn't do that you would kind of maybe expect her to do? What? Go see him. Yeah, you might expect when you said, when if someone came to her and said, you know, the man who raised you as his own daughter is outside in sackcloth and ashes and he's mourning and he's fasting, you might expect that she could walk down the hall and see him. She didn't have to wait to be summoned by Mordecai. She had to wait to be summoned by Ahasuerus. She didn't have to wait to be summoned by Mordecai. So she might go see him. What else? Yeah, inquire. Inquire why. I mean, you mourned at the very least. At the very least, it could have been or would have been the death of a close friend or family member, which would have impacted Esther because that would have meant it was a close friend or family member. So she should have gone to see him. She could have inquired why. What else?
Couldn't she invite him in?
She could have invited him in. Well, no, because he was in mourning. And when you were in mourning, you could not set foot on the palace grounds without Ahasuerus' specific invitation. So she could not have invited him onto the palace grounds. But she doesn't see him. She doesn't inquire why. You know, it's like she puts no thought into it. It's thoughtless. She hears of the problem. It upsets her. I mean, it does upset her. And she says, give him some clothes. As if that's going to address the problem. A very thoughtless response. But you know, when you think about this, it's an emotional response. It's a thoughtless response. There's no personal involvement here. Minimal personal involvement. Have we seen this response to a problem in the book of Esther before? Stretch a little bit. Haman comes to Ahasuerus. He says, hey, Ahasuerus, you've got a problem. You've got a problem throughout the kingdom. And that problem is there's a group of people who aren't like us. They don't talk like us. They don't think like us. Their customs are different than us. They don't obey your laws. I'm going to give you some money and I'm going to go kill them. Okay? And Ahasuerus does not personally invest himself in that situation. He doesn't inquire who are these people. He puts no thought into it. He puts no personal attachment into it. Nothing. He simply responds to that problem in an emotional, thoughtless, detached way. In a very real way, Esther's response to Mordecai's position is the same as Haman's response or Ahasuerus' response to the Jewish people. Very little thought, very little personal investment, an emotional response. You know, 5 years have passed since Esther and Ahasuerus have married. Do you think 5 years earlier, if somebody had said to Esther, you know something, your uncle, the man who raised you, is out on the street mourning and weeping and wearing sackcloth, what do you think her response would have been then? She would have run to that man. She would have ministered to that man. But the reality is, she has lived in comfort and compromise for 5 years. And the longer we live in comfort and compromise with the world, the more we begin to look like the world. If you think about that, the world doesn't begin to look like Christians when we live in compromise. We begin to look like the world. Esther's thought processes, her approach to problems, her attitude toward people, even someone, the closest person she has to family on the face of the earth, have all undergone a five-year revamp. This is really how the world addresses problems today, for the most part. This is how the world addresses problems. When you turn on the 10 o'clock news, what do you see mostly? Murder, earthquakes. And they're all in film clips, aren't they? Well, not film clips, whatever they are now. But there are pictures, there are little videos of catastrophes around the world. You know, they always had that world section. There's all these pictures of what's going on. And you know something? What's the first response? The first response is always based on what? Emotion. That's what they're reaching out to. But what's the primary way the world addresses problems? When you hear of a problem, we heard the problem down at West, when that explosion was at West. What was the first response? Send money. Send money. That is the primary response is send money, send food, send clothes, give. But it's a financial response. It's an emotional response and a financial solution. The primary solution or the primary focus of the world solution is to respond emotionally, send funds, send resources. Don't put a lot of thought into it. Don't put a lot of personal investment into it. The problem is, what happens tomorrow? What happens tomorrow? There's something else. There's something else. There's an earthquake someplace else. I have an aunt and uncle and some cousins who were missionaries in Haiti for a number of years. And remember the big earthquake in Haiti. And they said, you know, the aid that came into Haiti in the 6 months after those earthquakes was just overwhelming. There was so much that a lot of it just rotted. They said there was so much aid, so much food, nobody was in charge, and a lot of the food just rotted. They had warehouses of rotted food. But they said after 6 months, enough other things had happened to the rest of the world that they never saw another dime. Well, because that's the result of an emotional response. You know, it's possible that Esther was embarrassed by Mordecai's carrying on. It's possible that she felt threatened. I mean, if somebody starts looking into Mordecai, maybe they're going to hook up and hook Mordecai with Esther. What does he do? Now, keep in mind, what does Mordecai do with the clothes? Sends them on back. And Esther has another response. Her second response is to ask, what's wrong? Now, that should have been her initial response, right? The second response is wrong, is to determine what's wrong. In the Christian community, when we determine that there are problems, that there are issues or crises, what are some of the directives the Bible gives us? How are we to relate to one another in times of problems or crises? We're supposed to pray for one another. Absolutely, we're supposed to pray. What else? We're supposed to minister. Minister directly to their need. Which means at first we have to do what? If we're going to minister directly, we have to first what? Yeah, we have to determine the need. You know, if we hear somebody sick, their needs may be A, B, and C. Their needs may be D, E, and F. We need to determine what the need is and minister directly. Pray for them. Minister directly. What else? Personal involvement. What else? I'm going to put encourage them. And that may be a call, that may be a visit, that may be a card or a letter. We're supposed to comfort one another. We're supposed to pray for one another. We're supposed to bear one another's burdens. But you know, the focus is always on personal contact. In the Christian community, when we deal with issues, when we deal with problems, they're supposed to be personal contact, and that certainly may be financial. I mean, we have a benevolence fund, and through that benevolence fund, we pay out tens of thousands of dollars a year. You know, every year when Tom gives kind of that year in review thing, part of it is to say, well, in benevolence this year, we paid out like $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. It's always way up there. And because that's very often a part of the need. But as believers, we're supposed to be hands-on to the problems of one another. The entry level is pray. And beyond that, as God directs us, we're to be involved. Mordecai's first appeal, though, fails for two reasons. What's the first reason? Mordecai is kind of giving a little appeal by showing up at the palace. What's one reason why it fails? Yeah, Esther. I won't say Esther's stupid, but Esther's clueless. She's clueless. But what is Mordecai? Esther's clueless, but really, what is Mordecai? He's what? He's vague. Yeah, the guy's vague. Mordecai's silent. He's just sitting there at the gate. There's a need, but Mordecai doesn't express what that need is. You know, if we have needs in our lives, and believe my dad was a pastor for years, and I can't tell you how many times people would come and they'd be all upset because the people in the church hadn't ministered to them in a need. And my dad would say, when did that happen? You know, we're Christians. We're not psychics. And they would never have told anybody what the need was. You know something? If we expect people to minister to needs, we have to make those needs known. We can't in pride sit back and say, I don't have any need. If we want our needs to be ministered to, we can't be like my dog. Sometimes I'll be sitting in the den watching television or reading, and my dog would just come and sit in front of me. And I'll say, what do you need? And she'll just sit there. I say, do you want to go outside? Just looks at me. You want something to eat? Well, you can't ask a dog if they want something to eat. They always want something to eat. But, you know, I go through a whole list. And finally, I say, she must need to go outside. And I'll get up and say, well, let's go outside. And she'll run away to another part of the house. You know, you can't just be quiet and vague. Doesn't work for my dog. Well, actually, it does work for my dog because I just follow around. Eventually, she gets something to eat. But we can't be that way. His first appeal fails because Esther is oblivious in her isolation, and Mordecai is vague in his petition. But we see his second appeal in verses 6 through 8, and it goes in. Esther's told her eunuch to go find out what's gone. So the eunuch went to Mordecai in the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him. So Mordecai responds. Esther finally is getting to the heart of the issue. Look at how detailed Mordecai's response is. What's some of the things he tells the eunuch? He does what? He tells the eunuch what? The money. How much money is involved here? I mean, that's going to be impressive by anybody's standards. What else does he tell him? He gives him a copy of the text. By the way, this indicates both Mordecai and Esther are literate. They're educated people. He tells them the details. He tells the eunuch the details of what's going on, and he tells him, take this back to Esther. You know, this isn't a bad reminder for us when we pray. You know, when we pray, we don't dictate to God, of course, what God is to do, but we're not to be vague either. If we have requests that we're bringing to God, we're to be specific. I mean, it's one thing to say, Lord, protect my children as they go out today. How do you want God to protect your children? What do you want to protect them from? Well, God knows. Yeah, God knows for physical safety, keep them from sin, keep them from bad influences, help them to find favor in the eyes of their teachers. Bless my business. How do you want God to bless your business today? Not just bless me, not just protect me, not just grow me, not just spiritually keep me, but how specifically do you want God to work in your life? Yes, God knows, but it's good for us to be specific, to be itemized. You know, one of my English teachers used to call those glittering generalities. Anybody have that? Glittering general? Avoid glittering generalities. Phrases that are like umbrella phrases that can mean a lot of things, but can mean nothing as well. That can mean nothing as well. You notice what Mordecai said? Give her the text and then do what? Mordecai ordered her to do what? Mordecai ordered her. He said, go to the king. What standing did Mordecai have to order the queen of Persia to go to the king? No standing. No standing. But he absolutely ordered her to go to the king. That underscores the urgency of the matter, and it also underscores the severity of failure. But there are two things Mordecai didn't do. First of all, he's still not doing what? Still not. Yeah, praying. Good. What was that thing that Hollywood Henderson said about Terry Bradshaw? He couldn't spell cat if you spotted him in the C and the T. Yeah, well, I was getting real close to the C and the T here. All right. But you notice what else Mordecai didn't do? Mordecai never demanded that Esther go into mourning. Esther is never commanded to go. She is Jewish. Did she have a right to mourn? Oh, yeah, she had every bit as much reason to mourn as Mordecai and the rest of the expatriate Jews. Mordecai never commanded Esther to mourn. He never said, take this to her, tell her it's time to get there, drag that old sackcloth out, and if she doesn't have any, we still got one hanging in the closet at home that fits her. Yeah, he didn't say, tell her to dump ashes on her head and start fasting. He said, go to the king. You know, it's important for you and I to remember that when God lays it on our hearts to address a need, even within the Christian community, our response does not automatically dictate everyone else's response. We can't respond to a need, to a problem, and look around saying, well, look at all I'm doing. I can't believe these people don't understand how important. Well, look at this. Look at this. I'm taking meals over every day, and you know, I'm organizing this kind of drive in a carpool. Nobody else is doing anything. Our response to a need does not dictate anyone else's, not even one other person's response. You have to allow each person within the Christian community to respond to problems and issues as God lays it on their hearts to do. And you have to be satisfied that you do what God has directed you to do. You respond as God directs you to respond. And allow everyone else's response to be between them and God. Instead of urging her to mourn, what does he tell her to do? He tells her to go see the king. Who's the problem here? The king's the problem. You never solve a problem by going to the problem. You have to go back to the source of a problem and maybe go around that problem or defeat the problem. But you're not going to address the problem here by going back to a king who is as oblivious as Esther was. Mordecai urges her to beg and plead with the king. We don't have time to go there, but in Daniel 9, verse 3, those two words, beg and plead, are used for intercessory prayer. Mordecai is basically telling Esther, ordering Esther, to go beg and plead with Ahasuerus. What's the problem with that? He's not going to change anything. Ahasuerus, by law, can't change the decree. He can't rescind it. He can't do anything from a human perspective about it. All he can do is say, that happens. Mordecai's second appeal fails because Mordecai's gone to the wrong court. He's appealing to a court where there is no power to act. He's appealed to Esther. Esther has no power to change what's going on. And he appeals through Esther to Ahasuerus, who has no power or legal authority to change it. We move to the third appeal, verses 9 through 17. Esther gives her response. The eunuch comes back, told her everything that that Mordecai said. And Esther gives him a response to Mordecai. And this is really the beginning of Mordecai's third response or third dialogue or appeal. What does Esther say to Mordecai? Does she say no? No, she doesn't say no. No, no. Does she say yes? She doesn't say yes. Does she even say maybe? No. She's a girl. I've had conversations like this. No, we all have given these conversations. Mordecai makes a specific request, and Esther avoids the issue completely. She doesn't say, no, I won't do it. She doesn't say, yes, I'll do it. She doesn't even say, well, okay, maybe I'll do that. I'll consider it. What does she say? What does she focus on? She focuses solely on herself, personal safety. That is immediately where Esther's attention is drawn. It's drawn to herself. What does she need? She tells Mordecai, I can't go in there. I need an invitation. I need permission. And I haven't had permission for 30 days. I mean, it's been a while since Ahasuerus has even wanted to see me. You notice that response really violates the two greatest commandments, doesn't it? First, the greatest commandment is, according to our Lord, love the Lord your God with all your heart. She never calls on the name of God. She never submits to the will of God. She never seeks the will of God. What's the second greatest commandment? Love your neighbor as yourself. At this point, Esther still feels bulletproof. Maybe she's young enough that hasn't worn off yet. Was there a time in your life when you kind of felt bulletproof? There was in mine. But then I got done, then I was 13, and I said, maybe not so much anymore. Age forces a certain vulnerability on us, doesn't it? But at this point, Esther still views herself as separate from the problem. Esther looks at this as a problem, as Mordecai's problem. Esther looks at this as the other Jews' problem. This isn't her problem. And so she responds from that standpoint. She responds from that standpoint. You know, when we don't see other people's problems as our problems, we will always lack empathy. I mean, we don't have to personalize every problem we run into, but when we cannot identify with people who are having problems, then we will always lack empathy to respond. Mordecai makes his final point. And Mordecai makes three striking statements to leverage Esther's cooperation. And what's amazing about these statements is that every statement is grounded on a presupposition of God. And Mordecai never mentions God. Every statement Mordecai makes is pointless, useless, and foolish unless there is a God behind the statements, unless the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is behind the statements. And for the first time, I think, in the book of Esther, we catch a glimpse of an acknowledgement of God, because God is the unspoken presupposition, as one theologian put it, behind every one of his statements. Mordecai makes three statements. First of all, he says, by the way, don't forget you're Jew too. He says, first of all, help will come. Second, he says, if not from you, revenge. And finally, that probably the most well-known statement of who knows that you were placed in the kingdom for such a time as this. Three amazing statements. And if we look at these statements as part of his appeal, every one of these statements presupposes not just the existence of God, but the active participation of God. Consider, if Esther refused to help, where was help going to come from? But that's the only place wherever God chose. If you were a Jew in Persia and you heard Mordecai say, you know something, Esther, if you don't help, we're going to be helped anyway. Wouldn't you sit back and say, oh, good, somebody has another plan. Good, there must be a plan B. Have we seen a plan B? No, there is no plan B. Somebody might say, oh, well, okay, if Esther won't help, maybe there's another Jew highly placed in the empire who might intervene. Have we seen another Jew highly placed in the empire? No. We might say, well, goodness, maybe we're subject to imminent attack by our enemies. And, you know, we're all going to go into the army instead of being killed on the 13th of Adar. That's not present. There is absolutely no other source of rescue except the unacknowledged God. If God were not in the background, if God were not the presupposed power, then help will not come. It is hopeless. So Mordecai's statement is based upon the presupposition of that God. Mordecai says to Esther, after we're saved, after that help comes, if you don't help us, you and your father's house are out of here. You're going to get wiped out. Little revenge. Little revenge. Who's going to take revenge on Esther, if not God? Under that scenario, suppose help does come from any source. Who's going to avenge the Jewish people on Esther? Is Mordecai going to avenge her? No, Mordecai's nobody. He's a low-level governmental official. Who's Esther? Before and after, Esther is still, what, the queen? Ahasuerus isn't going to avenge. That's his wife. Only a sovereign God would be in the position to avenge and have the authority to avenge. So when Mordecai says, if you don't help, we're still going to get help. And when we get help, your family's in trouble. Again, might clean up the language a little bit, but he's in the family. And then that famous statement, who knows but you were placed in the kingdom for such a time as this.
Going back to number two, something that comes to mind is so many times we think when God tells us to do something that, you know, one of the risks of doing that, and I think you bring up a really good point, is a real serious risk to not obeying God that we often miss?
You know, disobedience always has inherent risks. That's a thread that goes through the Bible. And even delayed obedience, when you think about it. You go back to our friend Lot back in Genesis. And you remember Lot was down in Sodom and Gomorrah, and the angels went to haul him out. And you remember that when they went to haul Lot out, did he come immediately? No. In fact, it took him what? All night. They urged him all night to leave. And finally, when he left, he had packed nothing. Basically, he escaped by the skin of his teeth. And he left. But there was a cost to his disobedience, or his delayed obedience. For one thing, he had to leave without taking anything. But you go further, and the example he set influenced maybe his wife to turn around and look back. Certainly influenced his daughter's conduct with him in the cave in the mountains. I mean, we cannot begin to appreciate the potential costs for disobedience or delayed obedience. Absolutely. Absolutely. And Mordecai is pointing out here, there is a price for this. But finally he says, who knows but you were placed in the kingdom for such a time as this. You know, when I looked at this statement, you know what he's arguing for? And this is great. This is really an argument for a meaningful course of history. I don't know if you've ever read any treatise on arguing for the existence of God. Not that God's existence is proved or disproved by any treaty. But one of the most common arguments made for the existence of a supreme sovereign God is the meaningful course of history. You look at the history of the recorded history of the world. And I'm not talking about 50 billion years ago when we were whirling masses of gas. I'm talking about history as it really exists from Genesis 1 forward. You look at history, and there is a meaningful integrated flow of history globally. If we had time today, we could step back and see how interrelated, how interconnected the history of mankind is. The development of mankind, the results of war, the results of expansion, how integrated it is, how purposeful it is, how meaningful it is, and how misspelled meaningful is. I said, God has an intelligent course of history, not me. And the argument is, without a sovereign being to direct the flow and the course of history, history would just implode. There would be a randomness to history. History would not interconnect. History would not mesh. History would simply implode. Because every time we see, we look at other scientific theories, evolution and whatnot, and those are just very baseless theories, there's this randomness to it. Every other theory than the theory that's set out in the Bible, than the reality is set out in the Bible. Mordecai is arguing a meaningful course of history. Mordecai is saying, look, I mean, we've been in captivity for over 100 years. You've come out of nowhere to be the queen of Persia. There's a method to this. There is a purpose to this. And who knows but that all this has led up to this point where you can be, where God can use you to help save his people. You know, it's so important that we remember that when God gives us directives, when God gives us opportunities, there's a reason for that. That's part of the meaningful course of history. It's not just a meaningful course of our lives. It's a meaningful course of the outworking of God's purpose on this earth. And that's what Mordecai is pointing to out to Esther, is there is a meaning to this. There is a reason you're the queen. And how can we say this isn't the reason? He's not guaranteeing it. He's saying, how can we guarantee that that's not the reason? That's not the reason. You know, everything Mordecai has said, everything he has done through the mourning process presupposes the existence of God. If there was not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob ready to intervene, what's the purpose of the Israelites' mourning? Does it have any purpose? No, it's just a public display. A rather distasteful, loud public display. There's no purpose to the mourning. If there is no God willing to intervene, is there any hope for Israel? No, there's nothing. There's nothing. There's no threat to compel Esther to act. Mordecai's statements and his conduct, everything is predicated upon the existence of that God. And ultimately, this appeal will succeed because Mordecai's finally landed in that court of last resort. He's finally reached the throne room of God. God is finally acknowledged, and God's power is viewed as the only power that's going to save Israel. Even so, Esther has reason to doubt, doesn't she? I mean, Mordecai's made these great statements and threats, but Esther has every reason to be hesitant. I mean, what might she be asking herself?
Why should I get involved?
Yeah, why me? You know, nobody knows she's Jewish. She's pulled this off for 5 years. And even if they found out, she is married to the king. So, you know, I got that. She's got that going for her. What else? I mean, Mordecai may be right. Help may come from someplace else. But what's equally as likely? Yeah, there's not going to be any help. I mean, this is a guy who's wearing a goat skin. How much validity do we want to give to him? And Esther might honestly ask herself, okay, can God really use somebody like me? You ever ask yourself that? You ever been put in a position where you feel that God is directing you, where there is an opportunity for service open, where there's an opportunity for you to get involved in someone else's problems, as maybe to contribute to the solution, and you really step back and say, you know, I think this is above my pay grade. I mean, can God even use somebody like me? Keep in mind, Esther is Jewish, but at best she's closet Jewish. I mean, she spent 5 years pretending not to be Jewish. There is nothing about her lifestyle that's betrayed her as being Jewish. She may well have had serious reservations. But as we'll see, God's answer to her reservations is an absolute yes. As one writer put it, God's providence in this world works through all kinds of sinners. After all, that's all he has to draw from. That's really the truth. Next week, we begin to look at Esther's response and her activity. And I think it says two things to us. First of all, I think it does remind us that we are to be careful about becoming isolated. Isolated even within the Christian community. Isolated from the problems of one another. You know, as we learn of needs, certainly outside the Christian community, but within it especially, we are charged by Scripture to pray for those individuals, to give some thought into what we can do, what role we can play in meeting those needs, to lift them up, to encourage them. You know something, we need to take that seriously, because even within the Christian community, we can become very isolated from one another. Second, it's a reminder about our approach to problem solving. You know, when you are presented with problems, where do you turn to? Where do you turn to? You know, mostly we turn to friends and we turn to family. We turn to those people who we know best. Some people turn to money, self-help books, whatever. As Christians, we're reminded that God is always to be our first line of defense and not our last resort. Psalm 18:3 says, I will call on the Lord. He will deliver me from my enemies. Let me tell you something. That promise is just as true today as it was 3,000 or 4,000 years ago when it was written. This week, you and I are going to face problems. Hopefully, none of us will face the death sentence. But we're going to face problems. When we do, remember, God is to be our first choice, not our last option. We're to turn to Him because God is honored and glorified when we turn to Him and realize His rescue, His deliverance in our lives. Let's close. Lord God, we thank You that You are a God who continues to deliver. We thank You that You are a God who never slumbers or sleeps. Lord, as we go through our lives, forgive us for those times when we become so isolated, when we become so focused on ourselves, our families, that we fail to see what's going on in the world around us, even the Christian community. Lord, as we become aware of needs within our church, within our community, Lord, may we put thought into what You would have us to do. Lord, may we personally vest ourselves in being part of Your solution. And Lord, as You use us, may we never be tempted to look at others and demand that they respond as we respond. knowing that it is an individual response, that it is an individual accountability. We pray these things in your name. Amen.